You're listening to Idaho Matters. I'm Gemma Gaudette. It is Friday, time for our reporter roundtable. This is, of course, when we get you updated on the news that made headlines around our area this week, and there were quite a few. Today, our panel includes Melissa Davlin with Idaho Public Television, Kevin Richert with Idaho Education News, and Clark Corbin with the Idaho Capital Sun. Happy Friday, everybody.
Hi, Gemma. Thanks for having us on.
Of course. So I must say, I was hoping that we wouldn't have to be talking about this again. However, we do. And that is COVID. And that is what's going on. Kevin, why don't you start out with what the CDC did, I believe, on Tuesday, which was reversing its recommendations on certain things.
Well, yeah, it was a fairly stark turnaround from the CDC. I mean, just a couple of weeks ago, the CDC had issued guidelines for back to school saying that if students or staff are fully vaccinated, there's no need for a mask. But what the CDC is now recommending is mask usage in a lot of indoor facilities, including schools, regardless of vaccination status. Now, what we don't know yet, and what we're going to watch and see unfold here in the next few weeks, is how do schools respond to that? How do school districts respond? Because a lot of the districts in our part of the state especially went out of their way to lift their mask mandates and go to more of an optional approach. I mean, Boise went there, West Ada went there. We're still about a month away from the start of the school year. One larger district, the Moscow School District, is going to mandate masks for the first 3 weeks of the school year. That was reported by the Moscow Pullman Daily News just the other day. That's the first big district that I know of that has reinstituted a mask mandate. We're just going to have to see what happens across the education system.
Yeah, and Kevin, even Boise State University came out, I believe, saying that they're not mandating it, but strongly in encouraging masks.
Right, right. And that is itself a little bit different than where we were a year ago. A year ago, masks were required at Boise State. This fall, the language now is a strong recommendation, but not a requirement. And that's kind of where the universities are, and really the only place they can be on the vaccination front. They can't require a vaccination, but they're strongly encouraging students and staff who have not yet been vaccinated to do so. Their vaccination numbers are pretty good, but they still want to see them get better. And, you know, really about all Boise State is doing right now is just is urging its community to take precautions.
But at least every student at any of our higher education institutions have the option to be vaccinated, Kevin. So that's why I find it curious about really these large school districts and even the parochial schools are at the point where it's mask optional. But so many of your students cannot be vaccinated yet.
Exactly. You know, the vaccine is not available to children under the age of 12. That might change September or so. That seems to be the prevailing sentiment right now, but school starts before September in much of the state. So that doesn't really help you right away for the start of the school year. And it's worth noting, even where the vaccine is available for students, 12 to 15 year olds, high school age students, 16 and 17, those vaccination numbers are very low across the state. And now, not nearly what you want to see if you're trying to get at any kind of number that even approaches herd immunity.
So, Melissa, COVID cases and ICU admissions are up. Can you talk a little bit about that? But then also the city of Boise, what it's done since the CDC came out with this new recommendation.
Right. In Idaho, according to numbers released by the Idaho Department of Health and Welfare, ICU admissions have doubled since last month. And it's important to note that we still aren't at the numbers we were at during the height of the pandemic thus far in December, when we were in real danger of some of these major hospitals going on divert, not able to accept any more patients and having to ration care. At several points in December, we were very, very close to that. So we're not there, but the numbers aren't trending in the right direction. And that is something that has a lot of public health officials worried. Couple that with what Kevin was talking about, mask recommendations from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. And the city of Boise we're not looking at a citywide mask mandate like we had until this spring, but in their own city facilities, they are going back to having people wear masks. And we're seeing that pop up with businesses again too. The Record Exchange, for example, said regardless of vaccination status, visitors are going to have to wear masks. They're going back to that. Walmart is requiring all of their associates wear masks regardless of vaccination status. That doesn't yet extend to customers, but I think going back to the uncertainty that Kevin was talking about with school districts, this feels a lot like last year when the ground was shifting under our feet and mm-hmm. and policies were changing day by day, especially toward the beginning of the pandemic and when we got more information about how effective masks were. That's where we are right now because of this surge in the Delta variant. Confirmed Delta cases were at 70 this week. They were at just 30 last week. And the state is still trying to get to the point where they can test all viable samples of COVID-19 for presence of Delta and other variants. And so the state epidemiologist told us last week, just because we don't have higher confirmed numbers of Delta doesn't mean that it's not a lot more prevalent than that in our community.
And we should note that the Washington Post got a hold of an internal memo from the CDC talking about basically how, quote, the war has changed. And in this internal memo, it says that the Delta variant is so much more contagious. They said upwards of how as contagious as chickenpox. And yes, even in rare cases, people who were vaccinated can spread the variant. And with that said, Melissa, something that surprised me was Central District Health actually stepping up and going hand in hand with the CDC recommendations.
It's important to note that these are not mandates. That's not what we heard from Central District Health this week and from other health districts around the state, quite frankly, but they are strongly recommending that in areas of substantial or high transmission, which includes almost all of Idaho, that people, even vaccinated individuals, wear masks indoors. It's also important to temper all of this with if you're vaccinated and on the off chance that you do get infected with a breakthrough case, your chances of severe illness are much, much lower. You're almost certain to be in good shape if you are vaccinated. The Delta variant is really especially dangerous for unvaccinated people and especially unvaccinated adults. But children, again, as we said, children younger than 12 who aren't eligible to get the vaccine are in that category of people who are at risk. And what we're seeing in other states is that children are more likely to get sick, severely sick. Mm-hmm. It's still a small chance, but it's higher than it was with the original COVID-19 virus that was circulating last year. And so it's important to take all of this in context. People who are unvaccinated are the ones who are more likely to spread this, and they're the ones who are more likely at risk of getting severe illness or dying.
You know, Gemma, if I can just follow on, Melissa makes some really, really good points, and I wanted to follow on them really quickly. It does feel like we're back to where we were when the world was shifting on us 16 months ago, but I think there are a couple of big differences. First of all, you do have a segment of the population that is vaccinated and has more protection than it had 16 months ago. But the other thing is we're just in a place where people seem to be, you know, COVID fatigue is a real thing. And, you know, if you go into stores, you can see it right now, even in the wake of the CDC's guidelines, you know, mask usage is really infrequent and makes it really difficult. This COVID fatigue, this mentality right now, it's going to make it very difficult for a school district to come back and say, you know, that mask mandate we had last school year, we need it again. And even though the science may be on the side of doing that, especially to protect kids who cannot get the vaccine, it's politically a very difficult thing to do. We're in a different place politically than we were at the very outset of this pandemic. Mm-hmm.
And I have to say, just as a mom, and I've talked about this before, not as a journalist, but as a mom with a child that cannot be yet vaccinated, my child will be wearing a mask. It is the least that I can do because I would prefer not to play Russian roulette with my child, even knowing everything that I know about the chances of my child getting severely sick. Another thing, Melissa, that I think is interesting is that you had a story come out this morning on whether healthcare workers who get fired for not getting vaccinated can actually collect unemployment. Talk to us about this.
Right. I was curious about whether people, as you said, who are let go, whether they're nurses or other employees at these healthcare systems that are requiring vaccines as a condition of employment, if those policies don't change between now and that September deadline, and if the legislature continues this course of not coming back to change the law that allows employers to do so, whether those employees would be eligible to collect unemployment benefits because they were let go from these healthcare systems for declining to get the vaccine. The answer is it depends, but it is going to be an uphill battle most likely for claimants because Idaho law errs on the side of employers having reasonable expectations of their employees. So essentially, if an employer can show that the person they terminated violated in any sort of misconduct, which is, you know, breaking a reasonable rule, a reasonable policy of the employer, and that would include a vaccine policy, a vaccine rule, then that case is going to be really, really hard for the employee to prove that they need those unemployment benefits, that they can get those. Now, there are a couple questions that I think are still hanging out there. You know, how liberal St. Luke's and St. Al's are going to be, and primary health are going to be with their exemption policies, because they do have specific exemptions built into these vaccine rules that with the September deadlines, if they are consistent with those, if those exemptions are that they grant are well documented, if the exemptions that they deny are well documented, you know, that's going to change the case of the claim. That's going to be considered by the Idaho Department of Labor. Now, the Department of Labor declined to comment, but did tell me that they do consider all unemployment claims on a case-by-case basis. So there isn't necessarily a blanket yes or no answer to this, but because Idaho law does say that if an employee engaged in misconduct, then it's hard to get those unemployment benefits, then these healthcare workers who may be let go are going to have an uphill battle.
Let's take a quick break. We'll have more with our reporter roundtable right after this. Continuing our Friday Reporter Roundtable, our panel today, Melissa Davlin with Idaho Public Television, Kevin Richert with Idaho Education News, and Clark Corbin with the Idaho Capital Sun. Clark, Lieutenant Governor Janice McGeehan held her third meeting for her indoctrination task force yesterday. Before we get into what happened in the task force meeting yesterday, Clark, for folks who may not be aware, tell us about this indoctrination task force, what it is.
Yeah, thanks, Gemma. This is something that Lieutenant Governor Janice McGeehan created this spring. And what they're really looking into, what they say their stated mission is to root out indoctrination and bias and critical race theory in Idaho schools. This was a big talking point. I know that Melissa and Kevin covered a lot during the legislative session. Education budgets were held up or killed. There was a new bill, I believe it was House Bill 377, which was put forward as an anti-indoctrination bill. This really kind of ground the legislative session to a halt this spring. And so this task force is kind of picking up from that point. It's chaired by Lieutenant Governor Janice McGeehan, who's running for higher office, who's running for governor next year. The co-chair is State Representative Priscilla Giddings, a Republican from Whitebird, who is also running for higher office, who's running for lieutenant governor next year. And like you said, this was the third meeting. They held their first meeting in late May, and they've met in June and July since then.
So yesterday, Clark, really focused on higher education, correct?
Yeah, yesterday was really all about higher education. The vast majority of it was higher education. And Kevin, I want to give him a plug. He had an excellent article at Idaho Education News earlier this week talking about how this meeting really represents the task force coming full circle. If you remember 2 years ago, when new Boise State University President Marlene Tromp was just arriving on campus, Representative Barbara Ehart and something like 22 other state representatives signed a letter expressing concern with things like social justice teaching, Black graduation, LGBTQ plus rainbow graduation, and other programs aimed at inclusivity and diversity. That's really where I saw this pick up 2 years ago, and it kind of came full circle with yesterday's meeting. And it was kind of all over the board. This task force has really surrounded itself with a bunch of like-minded conservative speakers, politicians, and political candidates who are sort of reinforcing what the group claims its mission is. But for the very first time yesterday, the task force was actually challenged a little bit. A professor of social work from Boise State University named Nafis Alam was on the agenda, and he talked to the task force at the very beginning about confirmation bias and about the problem with surrounding yourselves with folks who already agree with you. And Professor Alam said, quote, "If we're only confined to say things we all agree on, then are we really thinking, or are we just regurgitating what it is that we are asked to speak on?" Professor Alam talked about how for him, and he emphasized that he was just speaking for himself as an individual, not for Boise State, but he emphasized that his philosophy is kind of a point counterpoint philosophy of teaching, where he'll introduce a subject or a topic or a theory and then kind of go pro and con. And he said he doesn't see a problem with teaching critical race theory as long as there's other theories presented alongside it. And one of the big challenges, one of the many challenges that this task force has had this summer, is defining what critical race theory is. They've said it's Marxism, it's socialism, it's indoctrination. They said it's a lot of different things, but they haven't really made the case that it's happening at a widespread level in Idaho public schools or colleges and universities, and they haven't really defined it. I know Kevin and I and Melissa have talked to other outside experts about critical race theory really being kind of an academic theory, especially looking at the legal system in America and how bias and racism and historical oppression have factored into the legal system. But this task force really is throwing around a lot of buzzwords that get conservatives excited, but they haven't really, in my mind, made the point that this is something that's widespread that's happening in Idaho. In fact, we spent very little time over something like 15 hours of public meetings, very little time even talking about Idaho, quite frankly.
And Kevin, I do want to talk about what Clark mentioned with this article you wrote about how these educational culture wars are coming to a head, because I really appreciated your writing on this.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. And thank you, Clark. Clark really hit on the tension at Thursday's task force meeting. There was a lot of pushback from the task force, from McGeehan herself, about the State Board of Education. And that's where the showdown is going to be next month. You know, about the same time, the same week, the task force is going to have its final meeting. This is the meeting where they're finally going to accept public testimony. This is the meeting where the task force is finally going to come up with recommendations after these three kind of all over the map information gathering meetings, I guess you could call them, over the course of the summer. But at the same time, Gemma, the State Board of Education is going to be meeting in Pocatello. They have a diversity and inclusion policy up for a vote. And it's really getting at a lot of those same kind of programs, so those same kind of supports that Boise State has had in place for years, had in place long before Marlene Tromp hit town, that the legislators called out in that infamous letter back July of 2019 when she started her job, and really where these culture wars began. It's all going to hit at a showdown that last week of August. So if you're into political theater, mark your calendar for August 26th, because it's going to be wild.
And yesterday's meeting, yeah, Kevin, was really heavy on the political theater. A large portion of the afternoon agenda was turned over to a New Zealander named Trevor Loudon, who's a self-published author and a self-described expert on Marxism, who Idaho Education News reported that the Southern Poverty Law Center describes him as a far-right conspiracy theorist who's known for seeing communist infiltrators everywhere. And Loudon spoke for more than an hour, and he was saying things like, quote, pedophilia right now is being pushed as almost acceptable in the name of inclusion and diversity, end quote. He talked about how heads have to roll. He talked about not believing in the Department of Education. He urged Idaho to return to this, quote unquote, classic education that focuses on real math and real penmanship. And after about an hour, this guy got a standing ovation from most of the 100 people that were in the audience, most of them obviously there to support the task force and to see this Trevor Loudon speak. But he really veered far away from the topic of education, and he didn't give any examples or evidence for many, many of the claims that he made. But beyond that, there's no evidence that he set foot in any kind of Idaho classroom or college campus. Didn't really mention anything that was going on, but talked about communism and socialism quite a bit.
We frequently hear criticism that people from outside the state are dictating what is happening in Idaho schools. This, to me, was a prime example of that. From the side that is decrying people from outside Idaho having a say in what Idaho's content standards are. This is a gentleman who lives in Florida, who, as Clark said, didn't mention anything about Idaho schools specifically in his presentation, and was more speaking in general terms about these conspiracy theories about how communist China has a say in preschool education content. Again, without presenting any proof for these claims.
It is fascinating to me that there is such a fear of having children, even young adults, because this is even, you know, going after college, is becoming critical thinkers and teaching them the true history of our nation. But with that said, it should, as you said, Kevin, should be very interesting come August 26th. I have to say, I don't think we ever thought that that a State Board of Education meeting, Kevin, would be must-see TV.
I'm a season ticket holder. I kind of resent that a little bit. State Board is fascinating, but it will be more fascinating for the average person next month.
Yeah. So, Melissa, switching gears here, can you talk a little bit about tax relief that we might that certain Idahoans might be seeing really soon?
Yes, we got a press release this morning from Governor Little's office that starting next week, Idahoans are going to, many Idahoans who qualify for this, are going to start receiving direct deposits or checks after the legislature had passed an income tax relief bill. This would have been back in April, and it's part of a big income tax cut, $445 million for income taxpayers, both families and businesses. Now, this is going to be $50 per taxpayer and dependent, or 9% of one of the line. I'm not going to get too far into the weeds on your tax return, but whichever one of those is higher, that's the amount you're going to receive. There is an FAQ at tax.idaho.gov that you can look at. I also posted a link to it on my Twitter. But Idahoans who have lived in the state for at least a year, who filed income taxes here, should start seeing those payments in early August.
Let's take another break. We'll have more with our reporter roundtable right after this. Continuing our reporter roundtable, our panel today, Melissa Davlin with Idaho Public Television, Kevin Richert with Idaho Education News, and Clark Corbin with the Idaho Capital Sun. So, Melissa, Governor Little, he got on board with, I believe, what, 11 other states, asking the Supreme Court, the U.S. Supreme Court, to overturn Roe v. Wade.
Right. Governor Little signed on to an amicus brief, and this news was announced on Thursday, and he joined 11 other governors in this request. And this isn't a surprise. He has said consistently that, you know, if this opportunity arises, he has long wanted to see Roe v. Wade overturned, and that he did hope that the Supreme Court would do this. And so now those wheels are in motion, starting with this original lawsuit filed by the governor of South Carolina. So yesterday, the amicus brief from 11 other governors, including Little, joined onto that effort to support it. This isn't going to be a decision that's made quickly. It would likely be in the next term, so decided next year. So we just wait and see at this point.
Mm-hmm. Hey, Kevin, I want to circle back to what we were talking about at the very beginning of the program today, and this is COVID-19 and where we are. Mm-hmm. Talk to us about, you have an upcoming podcast episode coming out this week.
Well, yeah, Audrey Dutton, colleague of Clark's, former colleague of mine, with the Idaho Capital Sun, we sat down this week to kind of talk about the numbers and the Delta variant. And, you know, again, you know, she's our preeminent healthcare reporter in the state. So I wanted to reach out to her to get a sense of what she's seeing in the numbers and the trends. And again, you know, numbers and trends are not very good. We talked about it at the outset, but the one number that she pointed out on Twitter on Thursday night, and I looked it up and incorporated it into the podcast today, that test positivity rate that we've talked about so many times that gives you a sense of whether the virus, the outbreak is under control. We want to see that test positivity rate at or below 5%. It's at 8% right now. That's the highest it's been since January. So, you know, I started the podcast talking to her saying, you know, this is not what we set out to talk about here in the summer of 2021. We thought we were going to be getting away from talking about numbers and tracking, you know, what's posted on the coronavirus .idaho.gov page. But here we are. I'm checking it every day. I know Melissa's checking it every day. It's it does feel like spring of 2020 all over again, unfortunately. Mm-hmm.
I want to jump in on this real quick, Gemma. The test positivity rate statewide is 8%, but regionally, it's higher in some places. Folks in North and North Central Idaho, so we're talking Coeur d'Alene, Moscow, Lewiston, test positivity in some of those areas is higher than 12%. And so
are areas where the vaccination rates are lower, which would kind of stand to reason about what we're talking about the vaccination protecting against further cases.
And again, it's not just a question of where we are right now. We're talking about the trend. And as Kevin mentioned, after talking to Audrey, we're trending up. And like we talked about earlier this hour, it's not just in test positivity. It's in just about every metric when we're looking at COVID-19 spread.
There really isn't a number now that you would look at and say, that's a silver lining. I mean, it's all going the direction you wouldn't want it to see, including vaccination numbers, which are flat, you know, despite everything that's happening the past few weeks and everything you've been hearing about the past couple of weeks. Our vaccination rates have stalled at about 15,000 doses a week, and that doesn't seem to be budging one way or the other at a time when you want to see more people getting vaccinated.
Well, and I think there's a concern too of a perfect storm happening, right, Kevin? Because you know, the Boise School District goes back to school, I believe, August 16th. West Ada goes back August 31st. To me, this feels almost like a Groundhog's Day of where we were a year ago. And I don't think any parent, when we got out of school at the end of May, had any idea that this is where we would be going back into the fall semester.
But I think what you're hearing now and what you're going to hear people say more and more, because there's a lot to it, is the Delta variant has changed the dynamic of this pandemic. It's like the internal memo that you mentioned that the Washington Post broke today. We're in a different phase of this pandemic. And, you know, you know, as citizens, I guess we all got to get our head wrapped around that fact.
Right. And what we need to do to get it under control. I do want to talk about some other things because, Melissa, the ethics hearing in regards to Representative Priscilla Giddings, that'll be taking place early next week, correct?
Correct. And while I will be on vacation, the rest of the Idaho Reports team.
Me too.
We're all just checking out next week.
Yeah. Good luck with
so
that.
So, Clark,
everyone.
You're going to be paying attention to this?
I going to be paying attention to it?
Or is Clark? Is Clark going to be? Apparently, he's the only one that's going to be working next week.
You're holding down the fort, man.
Yeah, we're all counting on you, Clark.
Okay, but Melissa, tell us what's going on.
Okay, so to recap, Representative Priscilla Giddings was the subject of two complaints to the Ethics and House Policy Committee stemming from her actions during a previous ethics hearing over Representative Aaron Von Ellinger, which has been discussed at length on this show, on all of our respective outlets. And when the complaint against Representative Von Ellinger became public, Representative Giddings shared a blog post in her legislative newsletter and on her Facebook page that included the name and photo of a 19-year-old who was accusing Von Ellinger of sexually assaulting her. Legislative leadership received over 2,000 citizen complaints about her actions. Most of them were from a form letter created by the Idaho 97 Project, but still, there were a number of people who were outraged about this because, you know, she was exposing the name of this person to the general public. So two complaints stemmed from her House colleagues about these actions. One of them was from Representative Greg Cheney. And then the other one was a letter that was co-signed by several lawmakers, I believe 24 of them, including House Speaker Scott Bedke. It's important to note that this was before both Giddings and Bedke declared their intent to run for lieutenant governor. But I think both of those things were open secrets in the weeks leading up to that. So all of that said, the Ethics Committee conducts a preliminary investigation when they receive complaints. And if they find that there's enough evidence that merits a further investigation, that complaint becomes public. And they schedule a public hearing. That hearing is scheduled to begin at 9 a.m. on Monday. Well, I will be on a beach and not paying attention to it. But at that point, the chairman opens up proceedings. The committee, the ethics committee, has counsel. The accused lawmaker or her counsel, in this case, can deliver opening statements. And then the committee makes recommendations, or they can dismiss the complaints altogether. And so what's left to be seen is how the testimony is going to go. Giddings has very publicly on her social media said that this is a, you know, political witch hunt. It's all politically motivated by Speaker Bedke. It is because of the upcoming election. I imagine that the hearing has the potential to be pretty contentious. And it certainly, there's a lot of political drama wrapped up in this as, again, they're both running for lieutenant governor.
Clark, we know with the weather that we've been seeing here, I mean, the smoky skies, you know, these heat waves that we're seeing, you recently wrote a story about home building and wildfire risk, but also what we can be doing. So talk to us a little bit about that.
Yeah, thanks, Gemma. With all the smoke in the sky, I mean, I woke up this morning and was outside at about 8 a.m. and it was warm and smoky, and that's here in Boise, and I know a lot of people all over the state are seeing that. But with the extreme heat that we've been having in Idaho, with the record drought conditions, the fire officials are very, very concerned about the fire season that we're in and about what's going to happen over the next 2 months. And so what I tried to do is I had a story at the Idaho Capital Sun. Came out earlier this week on Wednesday, I want to say, but looking at like how home building and development affect wildfire risk, but also looking at a couple of things that people can do to protect their property. And the good news is that some of it's easy. Some of it is as easy as staying up on your yard work, believe it or not. And it's things like, you know, there's a whole host of things to consider, starting from the location where homes are built to the materials that are used in homes, fire-resistant materials being used in roofs and siding and things like that. But for existing residents and homeowners now, there's a handful of things that they can do. It's keeping your gutters clear of leaves. It's mowing your yard and keeping it short. I talked to several fire experts at Idaho FireWise and a couple of other organizations who talked about creating a defensible space around your home. And that's a term that I've heard a lot, and I wanted to find out a little bit more about it. But they kind of break the area around your home down into three zones. And the most important zone is right around your house, that area from like 0 to 5 feet extending out from your house. And so they're talking about like not using bark mulch around your home, going with rock or gravel, not having bushes and shrubbery lined up against your house where a fire could spread from the ground and fuels would accelerate it to burn your house, keeping things trimmed back, using drought resistant native landscaping when it's available, that's going to be less susceptible to burning, having thinner landscaping and areas in between your plantings and things like that. And I also, for folks in Boise, I went out to the Idaho Botanical Garden, and Idaho FireWise has a fire demonstration garden out there at the very end.
Oh, really?
And yeah, and they actually model some suggestions. They have the zones laid out, zone 1, 2, and 3. You can kind of walk through it backwards that way, starting at zone 1, which is by a greenhouse. They have different examples of grass, different examples of native plants, different ideas of how to spread things out. And it shows you really how zone 1, 2, and 3 can be different there. But I would check out Idaho FireWise, or if you're in Boise and you're going to check out the Idaho Botanical Garden, be sure to check out that FireWise garden at the end. They have suggestions for things that you can do that are really going to reduce the risk. I mean, one of the things that I talked about, we know that Idaho is one of the fastest growing states in the country. I think the census said over the last 10 years, Idaho is the second fastest growing state in the country in terms of like percentage movement. And so where are folks moving? In a lot of cases, they're moving into what's called like a wildland urban interface. And that's a fancy sounding term for basically meaning human development, mixing and bordering and intermingling with like wild lands, open lands, natural features and things like that. It's basically building into places where that had been wild before, whether it's out in the foothills, whether you think about the Avamore development, whether you think about Harris Ranch, a lot of the development in and around Boise and Ada County is occurring in these wildland urban interface areas where there's a much higher risk of fire. For everyone that was here, what was it, 6 years ago when the Table Rock fire burned in the foothills outside of town, the Oregon Trail fire, I think it's been 10 or 11 years at this point in Boise, that did claim houses and did, I believe, unfortunately, lead to one human death. Seen it in Boise, and fire officials are very concerned about the conditions right now. So I check out my article at the Idaho Capital Sun, check out Idaho FireWise online, or check out that fire demonstration garden for some kind of practical tips, things you can do around your home.
You know, Clark, it's interesting to think that the Table Rock fire was 6 years ago. It seems like it feels like it happened just a few years ago. But then when you bring up the Oregon Trail fire, it'll be 13 years in 13 August. Years, yeah, I only you. Remember that. I only remember that because I was on maternity leave with my my oldest. That's why I remember. But what's interesting, you go back 13 years to that Oregon Trail fire, you know, all of that new development where Harris Ranch is wasn't even there 13 years ago. So the development that we're seeing in those areas, you know, of course I would think wildland firefighters are highly concerned.
Yeah, they're extremely concerned. I mean, one of the fire experts I talked to said it's frightening to be sitting here, that it's hard to even consider what could happen potentially being in one of the most severe wildfire seasons of this person's life. And it is hard to think about, but that's why folks are issuing these reminders and to be very careful and be very careful when you're outside recreating, be very careful about burning. But to your point about Harris Ranch not even being there, you know, for a lot of the new people that have moved to Idaho, that have moved to Boise in the last 4 or 5 years, there hasn't been a real serious fire right here close to home in the foothills like there was And so a good reminder for folks to be very cautious, whether you're outside recreating, whether you're camping, or whether just around the house. There's a lot that you can do. And people talked about kind of the community approach. And one of the dangers is houses being built so close together that it kind of throws off the zone rankings that my fire experts were talking about. Rather than getting out into zone two, that may be the neighbor's house. And so they're talking about how the house next to you can actually be fuel for a fire that could affect your house. So they talk about having a community approach, thinking about some of these things, and being very, very careful and vigilant, knowing that we basically have a tinderbox type conditions out there for most of Idaho and much of the West, and the weather isn't showing any signs of changing. And so we've got a long ways to go.
Well, as always, I want to thank all three of you for taking time out of your Friday. Melissa Davlin with Idaho Public Television, Kevin Richert with Idaho Education News, and Clark Corbin with the Idaho Capital Sun. So, Clark, the rest of us are going to be on vacation next week. Hold down the fort.
All right. Yeah, we'll do it. And I know Kelsey Mosley Morris will have good coverage of the ethics hearing. You can check that out at the Capital Sun. But thanks for having me on, and have a great vacation, Melissa.
Thanks. Good luck.
More Idaho Matters. Yeah, more Idaho Matters next. Thanks, guys.
Good luck.